dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. A debate is raging among the American people on the issue of the Bush administration's drive toward an invasion of Iraq, and our communities in central New York are a part of it. This citizen debate is addressing aspects of the issue beyond the narrow framework of the official discussion, beyond the simple pro and con, beyond the does he or doesn't he have weapons of mass destruction. The citizen debate is addressing context, the ethics of modern warfare itself, and motives underlying the public justifications for war by government officials. Tonight, we'll hear what some of our neighbors are thinking.
The home soon like lightning, we soon will be riding my shiny black bears. No fat rich man's pony can
much of the official discussion of the Iraq war question is centered on the possession or future possession of weapons of mass destruction by the Iraqi government. The focus has been on nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. A weapon of mass destruction is one that indiscriminately targets civilians as well as troops. A strong case could be made that any bomb dropped on a city from an airplane meets this criteria. But what about depleted uranium, which has been used in a variety of weapons by the U.S. military in Iraq, Yugoslavia, and Afghanistan? This radioactive material has left large portions of those countries poisoned, such that children not even alive at the time of the war are now dying of cancer. Hundreds of tons of depleted uranium were used by American forces in these countries. For all intents and purposes, the land where the DU was used has been poisoned forever. Humans are believed to have evolved from primate ancestors over the course of the last 4 million years. At the end of the next 4 million years, the land where the depleted uranium weapons were used will still be radioactive. The Nuremberg War Crimes Tribunals following World War II operated under 7 principles of international law that made individuals accountable for the commission of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Nuremberg Principle No. 6 defined crimes as follows: crimes against peace, planning, preparation, initiation, or waging of a war of aggression, or a war in violation of international treaties, agreements, or assurances, and or participation in a common plan or conspiracy for the accomplishment of any of the acts mentioned in 1 above. War crimes. Violations of the laws and customs of war, which include but are not limited to murder, ill-treatment, or deportation to slave labor, or for any other purpose of civilian population of or in occupied territory, murder or ill-treatment of prisoners of war, of persons on the seas, killing of hostages, plunder of public or private property, wanton destruction of cities, towns, or villages, or devastation not justified by military necessity. Crimes against humanity. Murder, extermination, enslavement, deportation, and other inhuman acts done against any civilian population, or persecutions on political, racial, or religious grounds. When such acts are carried on in execution of or in connection with any crime against peace or any war crime. Nuremberg Principle Number 3 deals with the responsibility of governments as follows. The fact that a person who committed an act which constitutes a crime under international law acted as head of state or responsible government official does not relieve him of responsibility under international law. Nuremberg Principle Number 4 makes clear that citizens of those governments are responsible for their own actions as well, irrespective of their government policies, as follows. Quote, the fact that a person acted pursuant to order of his government or superior does not relieve him from responsibility under international law, provided a moral choice was in fact possible to him. This moral choice was a central component of a demonstration held last weekend at the Lockheed Martin plant in the town of Owego in Tioga County. A four-person team of volunteer citizens weapons inspectors, accompanied by about 100 supporters, attempted to gain access to the facilities of the weapons manufacturer, which employs 4,000 people in this economically depressed region. Jeff Kirby prepared this audio diary of events as they unfolded.
Okay, so the game plan is that the inspectors are going to get in the van and go over there, and the rest of us are going to walk over there behind them, except for if you feel that you're not in a physical condition to walk over there,
Blue van can drive people.
There's the driver. Everyone else walking? Except for the inspectors.
The inspectors are
we have a quick prayer for safety in our
Okay, we just want to offer a prayer here that our work today might be led by the Spirit of God, the Spirit of peace and of love, and that we might help to eliminate these the weapons of mass destruction, not only here but all around the world, and that the human family might be given a chance to survive. So we pray for this. Amen.
Amen. Amen. Amen.
Lockheed Martin actually provides so much money for so many different of our senators and other congresspeople that Congress is not going to listen to us if they're going to be making so much money. It's like my vote doesn't count as just a civilian because I don't have $10 million to give them in return for my vote. They've got that, so immediately they win. So it's important for us to talk with these corporations and hopefully persuade the civilians that are working there maybe quit their job and no longer produce these things.
Do you think that marching today is actually going to help that at all?
If we can change one person's mind, it's one person. Always is a victory with just one.
I'm high school aged. A lot of young people who I've talked to are against the war, especially since if there is a war, they're young and they would be drafted in a couple years or this year, and also they don't believe that people should be killed in our name or in anybody's name.
Are people convinced by the justifications put forth by the U.S. government for their reasons for wanting to go to war in Iraq?
I don't think so. Certainly not me. Certainly not most people I know. And I've hardly talked to anybody who supports the war. One of the reasons I think it's really important to show my voice is so that more people can know that they're not alone in coming out against the war.
For 1,700 years, our church has participated in the wars and killings of the various countries of the world where Catholics happen to be part of. And that's been done under something called the Just War Theory. It's only part of our Catholic tradition. The other part is Christian nonviolence, a witness that has continued through the centuries that there is really no justified killing for disciples of Jesus ever in any situation. And as you may know, our bishops have written to the President George Bush and said they find it difficult to justify the resort to war in Iraq. Difficult, but not impossible, because they have never declared a war unjust, even by their own criteria. So I want to urge our religious leaders to apply the other part of our tradition, the tradition of Christian nonviolence, which is the oldest tradition in our church. The first 300 years of our church, there was no participation in the war of the empire, very, very little by followers of Jesus. And it's time to end the Constantinian era of justified wars and return to the time when Christians follow Jesus much more closely in terms of being willing to love their enemies no matter what.
We're headed to Lockheed Martin because they are directly responsible for lives lost through those contracts. And we just want to bring some attention to that. Call for this company to convert to life-affirming activities and to get out of the business of death. We're not calling for the plant to close. We're calling for the plant to convert.
Well, I understand where you're coming from. Anyone passing this point would be subject to arrest. You understand that?
Okay. We understand the un-American ways of this country.
Okay, I understand where you're coming from. Our whole goal here is to keep this peaceful, though. All right?
Yes.
Well, what's the problem with us simply walking here? I mean,
this is private property.
Taxpayers support this institution.
I understand that. This is private property. We've been instructed to tell you anyone coming on the property is subject to arrest.
Why is it a danger? Why is it a danger for us when this is the place that is making
the
most dangerous weapons in the world?
Are on the edge there.
People must walk their dogs and walk along this driveway. I mean, can't we just get up to our other folks?
People do not walk their dogs along this driveway. This is private property.
The gate doesn't even prevent entry until way over there. I mean, why should we be treated differently than anyone else? We just want to be with our friends up there.
We're not going to do anything. We're just going to go up there and stand.
There are no normal barricades
here. Ma'am, I understand. I'm telling you what we've been instructed. This is private property. Anyone continuing further will be subject to arrest.
But this is private property where our tax dollars pay for everything that happens here.
We've come quite a long way here.
We're your major client, the citizens, and so we don't really feel like this private property is the same as my refrigerator or your tape deck.
Why don't you cut us a little slack? I mean, we're not wanting to get way, way up there or do anything. We just want to be with our compatriots up there.
We'll stop at the gate over there.
Yeah, we'll register there. That's what
it says all visitors must register.
We'll register.
Yeah, couldn't we register?
Wouldn't anyone else be allowed to go up to the gate and at least try to register?
We're interested in seeing what types of weapons systems are made here. As taxpayers who pay for these systems, we'd like to see what they are.
Is this a violation of international law?
I think so.
Okay.
sounds like it's uncooperative.
And they haven't been cooperative.
No, we'll have to report back.
Citizens can't walk, they can't go there, a visitor can't go to the...
What if we want to visit?
This is private property. Anyone traveling past this position is subject to arrest.
So we can't register to visit?
That's just for today, though. I mean, like, normally if you came in here, how do you come up here to...
Why do you have the registration so far past the private property line if we don't even have a chance to try and register?
Or no answer.
Yeah.
Yeah, we would...
Yeah, I think it'll work.
Would it be possible to talk to some people from Lockheed Martin? Could you send someone down?
They have representatives that will be in the area.
Oh, excellent.
Oh, great. Can we
are they going to come down to talk with us?
We'd appreciate it very much.
All that I know is that they're in the area.
Can we ask for communication with them so we can ask them to come down?
It's been passed along.
Oh, has it? Okay, thank you.
Good.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it.
Like I said, we just want to keep this peaceful.
Well, we do too.
Well, we're very peaceful. We're very peaceful people.
That's why we're here.
How about 17?
And they got out of the van and they walked past the gate because the sheriff hadn't got there yet. Because the sheriff was watching the group. The sheriff didn't realize that there was a van going on ahead with the inspectors.
I mean, they just let us walk right through. They told us to stop, and they only had one person at the time. And then so one person is arrested sitting in that cop car up front, and then the rest continued on up the hill. Now it just looks like they're just holding them there. They're supposed to read a statement as soon as the cops stop them at the top. So they have a statement that they're reading.
You're not giving us even the privileges that an ordinary person would have to go up to the gate.
Sir, I'm passing on the instructions.
No, I understand it, but I was wondering why that is. It sounds like a differential treatment, you know?
It does. It seems like you're stopping us a little ahead.
Is there an officer in charge that you can talk to? That you're passing on? Where did you receive them from? From who?
Is there an officer in charge that we can talk to?
There are other officers in charge. I'll see if I can find the answer.
We got some paperwork.
Thank you.
Somebody told me that you had rumors that the news of this protest had gotten to Lockheed Martin early in the week.
Yes. Yes, there was apparently a notice sent around to the employees saying something to the effect of not coming to work today because there'd be something going on.
How did you find out about that? What's your source?
Well, this is someone who works there.
Okay, so you know one of the employees?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I probably know several.
And the employees, in fact, didn't come?
I don't know that this particular person said that they'd like to come out here and just sort of see what's happening. So I don't know if any people actually stayed home because of that note. I would assume that some did, but I have no evidence for you.
How do the people that work here, from among those that you know, how do they feel about the issue of working in a place that's making these things with a conflict or the fact that they make a livelihood out of this? What kinds of things have people said to you when you brought up the issue of what goes on here with
them? There's ambivalence. There's, the pressure and the tension between having a job and being able to provide for yourself and your family, and also being able to follow a profession for which you're trained in science and so forth, and the difficulty of finding employment outside of the so-called defense industry in which to live out your profession. So there is tension. And it would be great if you could hear this directly from somebody, but I don't know how many folks would be able to speak clearly, candidly, because of concern for what might happen.
This sign?
Yeah.
It says, "Son, guns don't kill people, control systems do." And I don't know if anybody is familiar with what Lockheed Martin does. They install weapon systems into Black Hawk and Warthog helicopters, which actually do bomb using depleted uranium, which is a weapon of mass destruction, a radioactive weapon that will kill people for thousands of years, is causing birth defects, cause Gulf War syndrome in our own veterans, and the Department of Defense is not doing anything about it or doing enough about it. So that's why we're here. We think that if the United States is sending weapons inspectors to Iraq for weapons of mass destruction, international law compels us as citizens to do the same here, where there are sites of weapons of mass destruction being manufactured.
You know that this facility is manufactured.
But you can go to Lockheed Martin OIGO website, and it will tell you that they install these weapons systems into helicopters that are dropping bombs. And, Lockheed Martin itself is the largest profiteer of war contracts, military contracts. And so even if they weren't doing that here, I think that it is definitely a valid scene for a protest. But we know for sure that they are, in fact, sending helicopters from here to the Middle East, where they will be killing people, many people. And if you've heard recently, Bush has said that we will not rule out the use of any of the weapons that we have. We have 12,000 nuclear weapons. And it's just something that we have to do. International law, the Nuremberg trials after World War II said that citizens have a responsibility to stop their governments from doing what is illegal. And that's why we're here.
I'm Catholic at St. James in Trumansburg, which is part of the Diocese of Rochester. The Catholic bishops and the bishops of our two dioceses have not declared this war to be unjust. On the other hand, they are very clear that abortion is never justified, and it's undeniable that in this war, a very large percentage of the people slaughtered will be civilians. A large number of those will be women who may or may not be pregnant. So there is absolutely certain to be a large number of abortions caused by the U.S. slaughter in this war. The bishops need to speak out very clearly that these abortions are not justified. This war is unjust. The bishops will never go that far to this point, because if they say the war is unjust, if they clearly teach that, And it's their responsibility to give a clear teaching to Catholics of their diocese. When they say it's unjust, that means killing in the war is unjust, which is murder. If the bishops say that, they will no longer be friends or on speaking terms with our government. But that's their responsibility, and that's what they need to do.
We have to look to the powers that we have as people, and impeachment is one course of action, and a tax strike is another.
Well, the people with weapons inspector signs on their suits have been arrested. I believe it's trespass. I don't know. I haven't verified that. They're being given appearance tickets, which means you just like getting a traffic ticket. You go out and you come to court, whatever date it says on the ticket. They've been asked to leave. If they come back on after they've gotten their ticket, then they will be arrested and taken to court and be arraigned.
So anybody else in the future can expect to be arrested or, you know, treated the same way?
That would be, if they call us for assistance and they're trespassing, we treat it just like any other trespass.
And who calls for assistance?
Lockheed called this time. They are the complainant.
Oh, did they call? Yeah, somebody said they didn't know where the orders came from.
It's just, oh, Lockheed, certainly they called. Okay. Why else would we be here? It's just like you calling and saying that someone's riding a snowmobile across your yard and I want it checked on. They send people and you come with the appropriate response.
Okay.
And there was a lot more than one person on the snowmobile here, so there's a lot more cops here.
That's good. Remember that. Snowmobiles next time.
Do you guys have a bus or something to get back?
We'll
I really
okay.
don't like
we'll
you walking on 17th.
They wouldn't let us in. They stopped us, told us we were under arrest. And if we tried to walk past them, they took a hold of our arm and pulled us to the side of the road.
And who were they? Were these state police, sheriff?
Sheriff. Cuyahoga County Sheriff.
Cuyahoga County Sheriff.
We were charged with simple trespass, and we have a court date on February 13th.
Yeah.
Simple trespass.
And were there any people from Lockheed Martin?
No.
So they actually claimed you were arrested?
They told us we were
arrested. We were arrested and get charged with a simple violation.
Same charge that they charge a husband who breaks in to beat up his wife.
Out of the group, how did you folks end up being the official designated weapons inspectors? Did you volunteer?
We volunteered. Jim and I have both been in Iraq and seen the situation there, talked to the people, realized that the Iraqi people are not the enemy. Their children are dying of real strange cancers because of depleted uranium. The Warthog, which Lockheed Martin manufactures, delivers depleted uranium.
stand to our towers in the sky for the American slide. Even after the airplane and us bombing them back, even after the whip of fear cracks, I'm an American slide. Yeah, I'm gonna join the team, jump up on the horse, go along for the rape and be a good sport, be an American slide. Nowhere bound to get it, no, it's bound to come. Rome is rolling in the grave right now to give us room for some. Oh, give us. Shit out of them, we got them on the run, we're the American slide. Then we villainize them on the magazine, feed ourselves a story just to justify the means, we're the American slide.
That was American Slob by Ithaca-based songwriter Crow Greenspun, a world radio premiere of his new Hot Off the Presses song. Very pleased to have it here on Unwelcome Guests. Earlier this week, the Cayuga Coalition for Peace held a public debate on Iraq and war. In a packed church basement in the city of Auburn, residents heard arguments from a panel of local experts and made some of their own.
Hi, I'm Kim Gilbertson. I am one of the people that helped to organize the forum. I was the contact person for this particular forum. And I have the feeling that all across the nation, in church basements all over the place, there are meetings like this going on, and they are determining the direction of our country. I believe that. I really do think that's true. All of our speakers here tonight have interesting things to tell us, interesting viewpoints, experience. Every one of them has come here on their own with not too much arm twisting and no salary involved. Nobody's even mentioned paying them for their services. You didn't hear that, right? So I want to thank them very much for taking the time out of their schedules to do this for us. It is deeply appreciated. I think that this is a great community service for all of us. The other couple of things I want to tell you is that the Cayuga Coalition for Peace is the main sponsor for this, and the coalition is exactly that. It's a coalition of several different groups. So I don't want to take up any more of your time. I'm going to turn it over to our moderator tonight, former mayor of Auburn, Guy Cosentino.
Now we'll turn to our program, which is the U.S. versus Iraq, the big picture. We have four speakers with us today who are going to take about 10 minutes to tell you a little bit about their views and their thoughts on the subject. Welcome are all of you to the panel. To start off, we are going to have Professor Tilley, who is with Hobart and William Smith, where she's in the political science department since 1997, teaching courses on ethnic conflict, comparative politics, and international relations. She had spent 2 years living in Jerusalem and in the West Bank in the mid-1980s, and she has been working with several NGOs, non-governmental organizations, in Washington, including the International Organization for the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, which is emphasizes research on Israel-Palestinian conflict. From 1990 to 92, she was the director of Settlement Watch, a research project on Israel settlement policy, and the coordinator of the Washington office of the NACC, which is the North American Committee for NGOs, on the question of Palestine. Professor, welcome.
Thank you. I thought it would be helpful for us to start off with some larger framing issues that would kind of remind us how much is involved in this conflict, and then maybe that can help us bring the questions together. This, of course, is a map of where we're going to war, right? Actually, I think it's well worth putting a map like this on our refrigerators, you know, and just sort of having them there all the time so that we can get more familiar with the cities and the bodies of water and how these things relate and the flying distances and everything, because this is all going to be on our news, right, and lives and whole states and societies will rest on how these relate to each other, right, who's next to each other. We're talking about a part of the world that is very fragile. Politically, it's and there are reasons why it's very fragile politically, and I thought I'd put up a few maps to talk about that. One of the reasons why, and I think we're going to get to these positions is one of the reasons I'm very frightened about an invasion, is because of that fragility, right? That there are very powerful feelings at work. There are different kinds of identities interplaying here. And we're not sure how some of those identities will respond to a major conflict at this point. For example, this is there's several identities playing out here. We think of the Middle East as an Arab region, but of course it is not really Arab. It's partly Arab. The Saudi Arabia section and Iraq and Syria and the Palestinian population in what is now Israel and Egypt are identified as Arab, but Iran is Persian, right? Speaks a different language, has a different understanding of its relationship to this region, and Turkey speaks Turkish, who's in Grant's tomb. I keep telling my students, speak Turkish in Turkey. So you have three different, very old societies here who don't see themselves the same way and have tensions with each other. And of course, all kinds of internal divisions within the Arab world. So that's one set of identities at work. And the other very famous set of identities at work is Islam. This is the Muslim world. We often forget, focusing on the Middle East, how large the Muslim world actually is. You can see here it's stretching all the way across North Africa through what we think of as the Middle East and Central Asia and up through Kazakhstan and down through India and all the way over in Indonesia, right? So Muslim identity is something that plays out, ripples out globally. And how Muslims see some event which seems to impact directly Muslim interests is another set of wild cards, which in every country would play differently, right? And you can see the way the green flows. It flows right through those different identities of Persian and Arab and, the Indonesians, of course, are neither, right? So how Islamic solidarity or different kinds of Islamic schisms will react to a sense of tension with the West, we don't know. Right? So we have to look at that in each case separately. And another identity, which is a very powerful identity for all kinds of good historical reasons, is Israeli Jewish identity or Zionist identity, the Zionist movement, which led to the creation of Israel. And there's, of course, for all the right reasons, the terrible history of the mid-20th century, there's a lot of emotion wrapped up with this country, a lot of fear, apprehension, excitement, pride in restoring a Jewish state. Right? And yet it's thrown Israel in direct conflict with the indigenous people of the region, the Palestinians, who are, of course, as we all know, living under occupation, and some of them are reacting with violence. And it's a very good example of the interplay of identities, because some of that violence is being couched as Islamic, right, as Muslim violence against the Jewish settler colonial society. And unfortunately, then we get this polarization with the Jewish Zionist movement remembering anti-Semitism and the terrible, the Holocaust of the 20th century, but also quite a few centuries of really nasty stuff toward Jews in Europe. From the Palestinian perspective, it probably wouldn't matter if they're Baha'is, the great Baha'i movement, but because of those, the way those identities have played out historically, we have that tension again here. How will Arab, Turkish, Persian, Islamic, and then the great split in Islam, Shia and Sunni differences work in the case of Iraq? Who knows, right? It's this complexity that we don't hear from the administration, right? It's this sort of dictatorship versus democracy line, which is, for me, greatly fails to engage with these interplaying and overlapping and old historical tensions, how that will interplay with something like the Ba'ath Party, which is this ostensibly socialist but really kind of fascist dictatorship in Iraq, which may indeed be, Saddam may be removed, but do you take away decades of dictatorship overnight? Do you occupy a country to do that? We've never done that. Right? We have never occupied a country to change its, except Japan. Right? Except Japan. Are we prepared to do a Japanese reconstruction project? My faith is low. So this is my kind of framing set of questions that I'm apprehensive, very apprehensive, about how all of these complexities will play out. I'll just throw out one last thing because it might help to lead into what I think Keith wants to share, and that is what we often forget about this region, which is that it's a decolonized region. It's interesting when I talk to people about the Middle East, and sometimes they'll say, oh, it's just all dictatorships and violence. What's wrong with that region? And I say, well, it's a lot like Africa, People go, oh, yeah, it is. I mean, Africa has terrible governments also. Well, why? Well, because decolonization is fraught with difficulties. The wrong people rise to the top in the turmoil of these new governments. It takes decades to sort out that kind of history. And the Middle East is also grappling with that. So no one really questions that these governments are bad. The question is, how can these societies be brought into accord with good government in these various countries in a way that does not involve terrible upheaval and violence? I don't think an invasion is the way to do that. So I'm going to give this over to Keith now, and I think he has some more detailed things to say about Iraq.
No, we have the LeMoyne students. Just raise your hand. We want to welcome you to Auburn.
Thank you.
They can take a whole host of courses, it looks like, from the professor, who started getting involved in issues in Eastern Mediterranean, the Middle East, as a exchange fellow of the American University in Cairo. He graduated with double BA honors at the University of Washington in history and Near East languages and civilizations. And after a brief period as a national parks ranger in Oregon and Alaska, thank you for bringing the weather, he began graduate studies in modern Middle Eastern history at UCLA. And he has a long list of items in his resume, but I would want to point out a couple of things. One is that he has been conducting research while living in Turkey, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, Morocco, and Egypt. And in 1993, he was an elections observer in Eritrea, a new nation at that point. He teaches, besides world history at LeMoyne, he does a series on Orientalism and comparative genocide, and we might get some questions on what that exactly is. And he is in the process of now setting up an ambitious new program in peace and global studies at LeMoyne. And welcome, Professor.
Thank you. I just came back from Iraq, and I have a very bad cold. And the joke that's been going around school is I must have been infected by some Iraqi biological weapon. So if I sniffle and I cough, that's why. I wanted to, as I begin, just quote from the most recent Zogby poll that came to me this afternoon right before I came. that will give you a sense of how divided our nation is right now in terms of support for the war, but also how that division in terms of support for the war reveals some very important cleavages in American society, both along racial, ethnic, and lines of wealth and politics. Right now, according to the Zogby poll, the nation is evenly split on the war. 47%, when asked if they support, said yes. 49%, when asked, said no. So 47-49. However, when it breaks down by various other dimensions, amongst Republicans, 71% support, 24% oppose. Amongst whites, 51% support, 45% oppose. Now, when you move to the independent bracket, it changes markedly. 41% of independents are in favor, 55% oppose. Where this begins to become much more lopsided and where you might imagine it would be the case is amongst Democrats. 30% support the war, 67% are opposed. Amongst Hispanic voters, 26% are in favor, 62% are opposed. And what I think is probably the most striking, especially when one remembers what a large portion of the U.S. military is made up by African Americans, 24%, only 24% of African Americans right now support the war, whereas 71% are opposed. Women are similar to sort of the independent bracket, with 40% in favor and 56% opposed. One more, I mean, these numbers, I'll rattle them off, but I can share this sheet with you later on. When Americans were asked if there are thousands of American casualties, 36% said they would no longer, 59% said they would oppose the war. If there were thousands of Iraqi military casualties, 49% said that they would, only 49% said they would oppose the war. So there's a 10% differential. But, and this is something that I found really heartening about this for myself, having just come from Iraq, that when Americans were asked if the war leads to thousands of Iraqi civilian casualties, 34% said they would continue to support the war, but a whopping 60% said they would oppose it. And finally, when people were asked whether or not the United States should go with or without UN support or an international coalition, 59% said the United States should not go without UN sanction, and only 37% said that they should go with U.S. sanction. So I think these polling numbers show that there's a real division in American society right now, and that right now is when the decision-making process is going on for many Americans. Unfortunately, my sense is that the President of the United States has primarily identified his individual constituency for this and has sewn it up. So whether or not, you know, there's enough of a popular movement to oppose the war will be successful, I think, is something that I doubt, because the president has been able to identify and solidify support in the portion of the population which already supports him. Okay. Now, let me move to issues on Iraq. And I certainly can answer more of these questions later on. I think the first question asked is, why was I in Iraq? I mean, that seems like a weird thing to do. I think my administrators and my department chair were asking the same thing, especially because I missed 3 days of class. I was there as part of a delegation of 35 American academics, graduate students, teachers, law teachers, philosophers, who were drawn from the list of 30,000 American academics who signed an email petition that circulated before Christmas. I'm sure some of you must have encountered it, in which 30,000 American academics said no preemptive attack on Iraq, which is a groundswell of opposition to the war. We were invited to attend a conference by the Baghdad University, and I don't think any of us were under any delusion this would be anything more than sort of state-sponsored Baathist political theater. But that said, and this is something very important that I want to reiterate now and at the end of my talk, which is that for those of us who went and those who have come back, the conclusion we have come to is that on one hand, it is absolutely fundamental that we oppose what Saddam Hussein and his government have done to the Iraqi people, but at the same time, we also have to oppose the war, and that these are not mutually exclusive positions, but rather positions that can be held simultaneously. If we're in favor of human rights for the Iraqi people, it seems difficult for me to understand how we could be in favor of a war which might very well kill many of them, perhaps the ultimate violation of human rights. Okay. That said, I just wanted to report on some of the things that I saw, both as an attempt for for me, I'm fresh back, for me to begin to organize my own thoughts as I move to write editorials and speak before other groups like you. And I'm around. If you have other groups you'd like me to talk to, I've come back explicitly to do that. And I should note, too, I apologize for not having my pictures developed yet. I really wanted to show some of them to you. I'll have them by tomorrow. And what I'll do is I'll post some of them on my college website. So this is a reason to visit Le Moyne College's website, lemoyne.edu, and the Center for Peace and Global Studies. For the primary purpose of our visit to Iraq was to meet with Iraqi colleagues at Baghdad University. And what's important to note about Baghdad University is that, but really before 1990, Baghdad University was a large, still is a very large campus with advanced technological facilities, a major research university, astronomy, engineering, physics, chemistry, all the things that go into making a great national university. It had something like 45 to 50,000 students now, of whom, and this is a very important statistic when one sort of thinks about neighboring countries to Iraq, half of all Iraqi college students are women. That contrasts markedly, of course, with Saudi Arabia, where women are not allowed to attend school with men, although there are separate colleges for women. As far as I could tell, there's absolutely no freedom of expression or freedom of thought in Iraq. It just isn't there. As Professor Tilley noted, the Baathists have morphed their sort of liberal nationalist sort of Arabism into the most vulgar form of sort of neo-fascism. And I can say that I'm absolutely sure of that fact. I saw it with my own eyes. That doesn't mean that Iraqis don't think. There's a difference. There's an essential difference between that, those two statements. What I did see, especially since I speak Arabic and I was able to spend time with some Iraqis on their own, they tend to be very critical of the regime if they know that they're not being listened to. But that of the regime when they're not being listened to. But that said, they're also very patriotic. And so there's this sense, it's very difficult for them at this point to separate an attack on Iraq, ostensibly to remove Saddam Hussein, with an attack on Iraq. And so in their own minds, I think there's a certain sense that for patriotic reasons, they would have to defend it. Now, I don't know if the college professors I were dealing with, knowing other college professors, would sort of man the barricades. But nevertheless, I think that it's a prevailing sentiment in Iraq at this point. With that in mind, there are true believers. I think that there's a sense that in a fascist regime, everyone sort of voices opposition to, or sort of pretends to be in favor of it. But there are true believers in Iraq, many of whom are related directly to the president's family, who derive a great deal of prestige and authority within their own society through their attachment to the regime itself, but also people I met at the university who came from very poor backgrounds, who believed that it was Saddam Hussein himself and the Ba'ath Party that allowed them to go to school, to study, to go abroad and come back and prosper in their society. These people identify with the regime, and they may not fight for it, but they would have a difficult time, I think, supporting anyone who might come in to remove it. So there are true believers. In addition, I also had a chance to go and visit Tikrit. And unfortunately, I have a map that shows where Tikrit is. Tikrit is famous for two things. The first thing it's famous for was the birthplace of Salah ad-Din al-Ayyubi, better known to the west of Saladin, the great sort of opponent of Richard the Lionheart during the Second Crusade. I hope that's right. And so it was seen as this great Arab gentleman who's in fact a Kurd. But very important in terms of sort of chivalry. Tikrit is also famous as the birthplace of Saddam Hussein and his sort of extended family. And whereas much of Iraq seemed to have all sorts of infrastructural problems, Tikrit was doing very, very well. Miles of lit streets, the restaurants were well stocked, and so on. Okay, so there are people there. The next point I'm going to make, and this will be my last point, because I want us to move quickly to questions, is that my time in Iraq, what I began to sense is there's a creeping Islamism, that there's a growth of Islamic, a subterranean growth of Islamic fundamentalism in Iraq, which is outside the control of the government, and it's hard as Saddam's government tries to co-opt Islamic fundamentalism. Ultimately, it is beginning to take on a life of its own outside of the government itself. What is some of my evidence for this? My first piece of evidence is 90 to 95% of all Muslim young women attending college at Baghdad University are now wearing what we sort of unfortunately call in the West the veil, but it's a form of head covering that we tend to associate with resurgent Islamism. Now, that said, wearing a veil does not always mean that you become sort of an Islamic fundamentalist. That's not what it means. But in Iraq, a country that has so established itself as a secular state, wearing that kind of headgear is a statement of resistance against the secularism of the state itself. Also, as far as I can tell, in the South, I was able to visit the Shiite cities in the South. We'll talk more about that in a bit. There seems to be a very pessimistic view about the future, but also a desire to chart an independent course. In other words, I don't think that the Shiites in the South will fight for Saddam, but rather will resist him upon an American invasion. That could be a real problem from a humanitarian standpoint, because as was admitted to me while I was there, there's a widespread belief amongst Iraqis in the South that Saddam Hussein has booby-trapped the important Shiite cities. In other words, he's prepared to destroy them, to suppress any possible rebellion, but to also to create a humanitarian nightmare for Americans. If you recall, what was one of those important statistics I read at the beginning of the talk? That if thousands of Iraqi civilians are being killed, American support for the war drops off by almost 50%. And so he's aware of this, and this is very, very worrisome for me. Okay. So finally, these are just some of the issues. Why oppose the war? Reason one, it will lead to an increase in Islamism. When I was in Jordan on the way, I accidentally stumbled into a Muslim Brotherhood demonstration at Jordan University, again, mostly done by young women, in which the leader of Hamas called the group in assembly. And one of the chants that went up from these Jordanian college students was, "Oh, Saddam, Saddam, don't forget Tel Aviv." In other words, don't forget the major city in Israel that was attacked sort of in a very haphazard way by Scud missiles during the war in 1991. Second, it's unlikely, as far as I can tell, that Iraq can ever be ruled from the outside. Thomas Friedman made a very interesting argument in the New York Times in the last couple of days, in which he said that either we'll take over Iraq as Germany and we'll have this nice democratic society, or when we take over Iraq, it'll be more like Yugoslavia. And I, having been there, know now that Iraq will more resemble Yugoslavia than it will Germany. I have no doubt in my mind, which will require a near-permanent American mandate-style occupation. Finally, I think it will create the permanent radicalization of relations between the United States and Middle Eastern and Muslim peoples. We will become identified with regimes that oppress the people, primarily the Saudis and those who oppose Islam. So please, I'm going to end here, ask questions. One of the things I'd like to share with you are some of the reactions that I've had from other people when I've told them that I've just been in Iraq and how I've been excoriated by the American right wing in the press right recently. So please, go ahead.
Thank you, Professor, by the way. Our third panelist is, again, someone who had appeared last year, I think, when the session with Scott Ritter was here on weapons inspectors and weapons of mass destruction. He is Roger Hare, who is a columnist with the Auburn Citizen. His counterpart is over here to my left. Imagine that. And Roger Hare has a BA and an MA in American History and Political Science from SUNY Brockport. He is a historian and writer specifically on Pearl Harbor. And as some of you may remember, when the movie came out, Pearl Harbor, he was the historian for their website. And we'd like to welcome again to our panel. Mr. Hare.
I'd like to start tonight and give a little speech. It won't take very long, but I want you to listen carefully. It is now some time since this latest war began. From that day in September until the present moment, there has been an ever-increasing effort to force the United States into conflict. The effort has been carried on by foreign interests and by a small minority of our own people, but has been so successful that today our country stands on the verge of war. Personally, I believe there is no better argument against our intervention than a study of the causes and developments of this present war. I have often said that if the true facts and issues were placed before the American people, there would be no danger of our involvement. If you look back over the record, you will find that those of us who oppose intervention constantly tried to clarify facts and issues, while the interventionists have tried to hide facts and confuse issues. We have not led you on by subterfuge and propaganda. We have not resorted to steps short of anything in order to take the American people where they do not want to go. What we said before the election, we say again and again today. And we will not tell you tomorrow that it was just campaign oratory. Have you ever heard of a member of the administration in Washington? Have you ever heard of a member from the administration in Washington ask you to go back and study a record of what they said before this war started? Are there self-styled defenders of democracy willing to put the issue of war to a vote to our American people? Do you find these crusaders for foreign freedom of speech or the removal of censorship here in our own country? I'm speaking here only of the war agitators, not of those sincere but misguided men and women too, confused by misinformation and frightened by propaganda, following the lead of the war agitators. As I have said, these war agitators only comprise a small minority of our people, but they control tremendous influence. Against the determination of the American people to stay out of war, they have marshaled the power of their propaganda, their money, their patronage. No person with a sense of the dignity of mankind can condone the persecution of the Jewish race, but no person of honesty and vision can look at their pro-war policy here today without seeing the dangers involved in such a policy, both for us and for them. Instead of agitating for war, the Jewish groups in this country should be opposing it in every possible way, for it is they who will be among the first to feel its consequences. Tolerance is a virtue that depends upon peace and strength. History shows that it cannot survive war and devastations. A few far-sighted Jewish people realize this and stand opposed to intervention, but the majority still do not. Their greatest danger to this country lies in their large ownership and influence in our motion pictures, our press, our radio, and our government. I am not attacking Jews, but I am saying that the leaders of the Jewish race, for reasons which are as understandable from their viewpoint as they are as inadvisable from ours, we cannot allow the natural passions and prejudices of other people to lead our country to destruction. This administration carrying this war to the people have fooled everybody. They have used the war to add unlimited billions to a debt which was already the highest we have ever known. And they have just used the war to justify the restriction of congressional power and the assumption of dictatorial procedures on the part of the president and his appointees.